show.
For Thursday, January 25th, 2017. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Wow, does it feel good
to say that
after being a week away for several weeks? Everything's changed. I'm back. Norm's back. Everything's changed. I mean, if you're watching the video, things may not have changed for you guys.
No.
For me, coming back in the office, what's going on? Everything looks so new and brightly lit and well organized mm-hmm. and shiny.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I wish Jeremy and I could take any credit for this.
There's purple lights back there.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Those might even be changing from week to week.
I really like that.
Or based on how many people are tweeting at us during the show, which was Jeremy's idea.
I suggested we can change the color based on some tweet to Twitter, you know, to tested.com.
Wait, but that's not in real time, though, because we don't broadcast this
live. They wouldn't know. Like, they'd have to, like, we could, like, say...
This is not HQ trivia.
We're going live now, and then they could, like, hit a color, like, 15 minutes later, then watch the podcast tomorrow, and it would be that they affected it. It's maybe not a good idea.
No, why not a scrolling bar of text that captures tweets, then?
Oh, that's dangerous.
Right?
Then you're talking about NSFW.
We can put in filters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it becomes a game.
Mm-hmm.
Who can overcome the filters?
That's right. Well, after 2 weeks away, I am back. it was a long trip. I can't, unfortunately, share too much of what we did on the trip, but I can say we were there in New Zealand with Adam and Joey, and we were filming some things for Tested that you'll see pop up on YouTube and for our subscribers.
Can you explain the plane ride that we all saw on Twitter?
Oh, yeah, that is the one thing I could share, which is like a crazy thing. And I will be upfront in saying that I'm very sorry. Unfortunately, there is no Tested video associated with that ride.
Okay.
Yeah, I know that some people were expecting that, and I think they rightly expected it, but we didn't go into that ride and that situation that day with our gear, with the expectation that we were filming something. That was a very generous offer from our host, and we were able to go up on that ride. So New Zealand, of course, a wonderful country, 4 million amazing people, and in the film world, maybe most well-known recently for the production company that made Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit series. Mm-hmm. So Peter Jackson, who directed The Hobbit, lives there. Sir Richard Taylor lives there as well, who runs Weta Workshop, and Adam's friends with both of them, and we went to visit. Ahead of Adam going on tour for Brain Candy, which he's still on right now if you're in Australia, around Australia, about, I think, 5 or 6 cities in Australia. So we spent a week mostly at Weta Workshop, and we've had some podcast episodes we recorded for Still Entitled that I think you guys should really listen to. There's one this past week that we chatted with Richard Taylor about the running of a modern special effects company and a practical effects company.
I want to go pick up a spool of number 8 wire.
Yeah, that's like the duct tape of New Zealand. You have to listen to the podcast to get that reference. But they don't work on weekends, so on the weekends they go off into the countryside, the Wairarapa, as they call it, about an hour northeast of Wellington, where they're based out of.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Jackson, who's really into World War One. I don't know. They're both really into World War One, both in terms of the history of it and also how it impacted the Kiwis, their people, because they participated in World War One, and it was one of those first things that gave them an identity separate from the British Empire. So
Peter Jackson is from New Zealand? I know he lives there.
Yes.
I
believe they're both from New Zealand. I know Richard Taylor 100% grew up in New Zealand.
Cool.
The BBC actually just announced that Peter Jackson's next project is going to be a documentary that he's producing for them and directing about World War One, in which he's restoring some amazing footage that they have.
Wow.
That the British Museum has.
Is it going to be a New Zealand-centric
no.
version of World War One?
No.
Most of the World War One we see is always, you know, centered in Europe.
I'm going to look up the specifics, but I believe it is a World War One film about the whole war using footage about from the archives of the BBC and the London Imperial War Museum. So it's maybe a Eurocentric view, and it'll be part of the BFI London Film Festival this fall. I cannot confirm or deny that we saw any footage of said documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But suffice to say, he's really into World War One. If you ever have a chance to go to Wellington, there's two great museums. Te Papa, which is one of their national museums, has an exhibit called The Scale of Our War that What a Workshop worked on, and we were able to cover. So we will have a video about that. And then there's the Great War exhibit, which was produced by Peter Jackson. That is definitely about the war as a whole, and has lots of replica weapons, vehicles, dioramas set up. It's pretty incredible. But anyway, that all is to say that part of his fascination of World War One is also in the vehicles of World War One, specifically the airplanes. So Adam was able to, I think we'll probably hear more about Adam from this on Still Entitled in the future, but Adam's grandfather flew airplane or trained to fly in World War One.
Wow.
And Peter Jackson has one of the airplanes that a remake or a restoration or a rebuild mm-hmm. of one of that very model that Adam's grandfather trained on. And so Peter invited Adam out to this hangar.
That's incredible.
Did they make this connection while they were in New Zealand together?
No.
They knew this ahead of time.
I think they had been corresponding.
Because that's insane. That's amazing.
Yeah, and it was one of those. I think Adam shared some information about his grandfather's name and service dates. And
wow.
Then Peter has the information to dig up and find out where they trained and where they participated and in this instance, what plane he flew.
Wow.
And so it wasn't exactly that plane, but it was the model of that plane.
Yeah.
And, right. And what we discovered was that Peter is not only into, and he has a company, Wingnut, which is the name of his production company, also makes scale model airplanes.
Uh-huh.
And we're hoping to build some in the future. But he has taken upon himself to fund the restoration and build from scratch some of these World War One airplanes to get them in the air again. And there was a hangar that we walked into that had, I didn't count the exact number, but there must have been like around 10 or 12 airplanes in the hangar. From different eras. There was, I think, what looked like a Corsair from World War II, but most of them World War One, like biplanes and triplanes with propeller planes. And they rolled one out, and this one that we rode in was a British RE-8 airplane, a biplane,
uh-huh.
with a big wooden propeller. It looked very much like new because it was built from scratch using exact blueprints and schematics as the original airplane. And it had two seats, pilot seat and a rear gunner seat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the rear gunner seat was a non-operating but model of a machine gun that the gunner would
wow.
actually use.
And the rear seat can rotate, I assume?
It does rotate.
How does that work?
So it's on you sit on basically a stool.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's not a comfortable, like, you know, seat with a backing. You're in a stool.
Oh, okay.
And instead of having like a 6-point harness, you're wearing a harness, but the harness is tied with like a metal wire to the airplane. So we weren't flying at very high speeds or very high altitudes, and we're actually encouraged to stand up like while the plane was in flight because we're pretty secure. They do all the safety checks.
I don't imagine.
That's insane.
I don't imagine that. That you weren't flying fast or high mattered to you. Like, you were flying.
You still feel it. You yeah. still feel it. And so Adam went up first, and if you look at his Instagram, you'll see some photos. He actually brought his own, like, aviator, like, goggles and his Snoopy cap.
Oh, he was prepared for
yeah.
this.
Yeah. So he put on, and you can see, like, the gunner in that photo, the machine gun. And that gun is on a swivel. So the stool itself swivels,
uh-huh.
and the turret swivels.
Is it hard to turn the gun?
It's pretty heavy. I mean, it has, like, they had some cords on it so it wouldn't, like, bounce around.
Uh-huh.
And it's non-operating, so it's, like, the idea is that you can get a sense of what it's like to hold mm-hmm. something like that, but you're not really, like, encourage the actively swivel because they don't want it to swivel around and knock your hand or something, yeah. right? So, you know. But the pilots were amazing. Gary was named our pilot and a total pro, made us really comfortable. We went up in the air. Adam went first. And after Adam took off, two things happened.
Mm-hmm.
Peter said, oh, now we're going to chase him down with this other. We're going to chase him, shoot him down, jokingly.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? He goes, well, I'm going to send another plane up to take him down. I was, oh? Ha, 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 Peter, that's really funny. And then off to the side, a German Fokker triplane rolls out and starts going onto the runway and takes off. And so the theatrical aspect of it was that as a surprise,
wow.
You know, Adam thought he was going up for a sightseeing view of New Zealand, and he got another plane coming out of the clouds, a perfect day for this.
Wow.
Out of the clouds and then chasing him.
Yeah.
So he would have to shoot it down. You know, not really shoot it down, but like feel what it would feel like to have a plane chasing you.
And so there was no one in the gunner seat of the German plane?
No. It was one. I think it was a one-seater, and it was just chasing them the entire time.
That's amazing.
That was the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened was Peter then drove a double-decker London bus, not the modern one. In World War One, all the red buses in London were commandeered for the war effort. And the red buses were painted olive green, and he has one. There's one actually at the Great War exhibit as well. It's not massive. It's like a shorter bus, mm-hmm. but it's that exact model. And he said, "Jump on board!" And so we all climbed on the bus, got on the second level of it, and he drove us off closer to where the plane was taking off, so we get a closer view of being taken off. And so many of the photos I took were from that bus. Mm-hmm. And then after Adam came down, he offered us flights when we weren't expecting it at all, and we're like, okay, yeah, if there's time.
Peter did.
Sure, yeah.
That's amazing.
So Joey got strapped in, I got strapped in, and we were talking amongst ourselves of like, could we bring our gear up? How windy was it? And there was definitely wind. It's, you know, it's open air.
Yeah.
So if you had your cell phone, you weren't holding it tight, you could lose it. And so we had camera straps. And
you brought up your SLRs.
Brought my SLR, yeah.
Those pictures are amazing.
And so Adam said something interesting. He found it that even though the plane was chasing him and there was like this model of a gun in front of him, he didn't, like, his body refused to aim the gun.
Oh, I can totally understand.
Right?
That.
Like, yeah, absolutely. You're just trained not to want to point something that looks like a gun at anything. And I had a similar thing. Like, I didn't feel comfortable wanting that, but I had no problem having the camera and, like, snap, 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 snap. Shot. Cap it. Got it.
What was the ride like?
So smooth. I mean, no stunts or anything. It wasn't doing hard turns. It was a very, very gentle ride.
Loud, I imagine.
Yeah, loud for sure. And we didn't have any communication between the pilot and me terms of like modern audio systems. Yeah.
Keeping it real.
Yeah. But the guy was total pro, and it was about a 15-minute flight, and it was exhilarating.
Wow. Yeah. I mean,
Joey did take up his GH5. And I believe he has some video, so hopefully he'll be able to process that and share some of that.
Like Ashore said, your photos were amazing. I mean, they really, the ones you shared, I'm sure you have many more.
Yeah, yeah.
You picked some amazing ones to share where it almost looks tilt shift.
It looks like fake.
The perspective is weird.
Yeah.
It's neat.
I use my, one of my favorite things from last year, my 135mm f2 lens, which it's a prime lens. So I couldn't do the thing where I couldn't go wide and show what it looked like in the cockpit. Right, so I had to kind of choose, show the cockpit and show like what it looked like. You know, if you had a GoPro in there, you get that really nice sense of like the wings and the beautiful, beautiful interior of the plane. But there's a longer lens. I chose that because I knew the other plane was going
to
come.
And you wanted to bring it closer.
And I wanted to bring it closer. I wanted to say it's more about air-to-air photography.
Yeah.
And I was really happy with some of those photos. There's one where Joey's taking off. You'll find in my Twitter feed, it's like one of the first photos posted from that, where it's right like maybe 30 feet off the ground on the runway. And I was very lucky to get it perfectly centered and level. And you can see Joey, if you zoom in, he has his camera and he's waving. And he's holding his camera shooting me while I'm shooting him.
You know, the child in me wants to see Peter Jackson install laser tag on these planes.
It was that very thing was discussed, Jeremy.
I'm sure it
no,
was.
No, no, no. Like, we're like literally the talk of, how difficult would it be to install laser tag on these planes?
But then you're talking about laser tag for the super rich, and then who gets to really play that? Not me.
Coupon day.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I'm a electronics expert. I'm just here to test things out.
Yeah, right.
And do a review.
So yeah, thanks to Adam, of course, for bringing us on that day trip. Before we got started on our real production that week, and huge thanks to Sir Peter Jackson for taking himself there. And that wasn't even the highlight of our week.
Oh my gosh. We get to hear about that later, right?
Later.
How much later?
We have a lot of footage to go through, so okay. it may be a month or two. But the idea for people out there is that, just like we spent a week and a half with Terry English last year, and we did our King Arthur armor build series.
In England.
In England, we went with the mission of doing something similar, but at Weta Workshop, with a different flavor. It's something that I don't think many people will expect. So you have to look forward to it, but it will take about a month or two to get that processed and edited.
It's a good tease.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to play some music? We have another topic here.
Well, I think there's one thing that happened last week that we didn't get to talk about because it came out while we were recording the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think it was the biggest story of the last week, even though it's been a full week since it came out.
Yeah, so I don't know if people are tired of it. We can't bring much new to it, but...
I think we can bring a different perspective on it.
Okay, well, we're all probably excited about the new Nintendo Labo kits, games, maker kits.
I don't know what to call it either.
I'm going with Labo.
Labo?
Label? No, no, Labo? But I mean, like, is it an accessory? Is it a... Like, I don't know what...
Was this... give me the context for the announcement for this, because was this one of those Nintendo Direct events where they talked about the slate of Switch games coming out this year, and then this was a big surprise?
I didn't even see that there was an event. I just saw a video released.
Nope. Yeah, this is just some, you know, way pre-E3 announcement. I'm surprised they didn't save it for that.
Huh. Okay.
Which
so,
makes me
well,
think
it's coming
like,
out. It's coming out before E3. It's coming out on April 20th.
Yeah.
This year.
When is E3?
E3 is going to be in June.
Okay.
So the idea is that this is an accessory pack. There are two kits you can buy. Are there games associated with those kits, these cardboard kits? Or?
Oh, yeah. And that's what I think a lot of people who are wondering, like, why is this so expensive? They don't get that. Like, they don't consider...
It's like $80, right?
They don't consider the software component. It's $70 for the variety kit and $80 for the robot kit.
Right. And people are looking at this and like, what? I'm paying $80 for some scored cardboard?
Exactly. Yeah, but actually it comes with the full game and all the software and engineering spent to make it work.
So sell me on this. I mean, I've already pre-ordered it because we're going to build some. But sell me on the idea of why people were freaking out over this announcement.
It's so different. It's like straight up Nintendo. It's just, you know, thinking outside the box and making boxes. The variety kit, I think, is even more compelling, not just because it's $10 cheaper, but because there's so many different things.
There's so many different
things. So what do we get? You get the photos show some scored cardboard,
yeah,
right?
So there's a lot of kits. You can build a piano.
Okay.
And everything uses the Nintendo Switch controllers in some respect.
The Joy-Cons.
Yeah, the Joy-Cons.
I want to talk about that more, because that's sort of amazing that it can use the IR technology from that. So, like, you could depress a cardboard key, uh-huh. And I'm assuming the IR... Is it detecting the press.
It interrupts it or sees something.
It sees something.
But what's more amazing to me is that, like, and there are a lot of keys. I haven't counted them, but there's like 13 keys. And it can do chords. It doesn't just see, like, how far away one key is and, you know, approximate what key that should be. You can play multiple keys at the same time. So I can't wait to build it just to see how it works.
It also opens up all these possibilities. If it has that kind of IR sensitivity, it must... I don't know if there's like different markers on the bottom that need to be lined up for that IR sensing. But if you have that kind of a specialization, then you can start to build your own versions.
Well, let's talk about how Nintendo could have done this, right? They could have done a Guitar Hero way, right? One game, you're paying for, they're selling the software experience first, and you need the plastic toy accessory, which comes with its own manufacturing challenges. Mm-hmm. And so if you do it like the Guitar Hero way, you have one game, you have to buy the guitar, it has electronics that they're putting in addition to the injection molding process.
Yep.
You're buying this plastic toy, and then you may, after you finish the game, you're done with it. So here...
And how much is a Guitar Hero guitar?
Maybe right, that's like $100 full
bucks?
Price, full $100. I mean, much cheaper now, but when that launch, plus the $60 game.
Yeah.
And so here, you have the advantage of these modular Joy-Cons, and now they're calling these systems Toy-Cons. And they're selling you on novel software experiences, and they don't need to have full $60 worth of game there because it can have multiple $20 games, $10 games, mini experiences.
Yeah.
And every experience is going to be a little different because you're using the Joy-Cons in a novel way. And you're not needing to buy five plastic toys because you're buying one kit and you're just building your own little cardboard
and
toys.
Don't forget, like, the joy here, I think half of the joy is not in the playing the game.
It's the building.
It's the building of it.
100%. I'm a little skeptical of that. I think you get a lot of value out of, like, keyboard plus robot and what are some of the other things.
Yeah.
But the building, I think they're selling a great message that, like, you're doing some physical construction and the way they're enabling the sensors and the Joy-Cons is really novel. And it's a great thing, of course. I completely agree. Fun thing to do with your kid. But in the end, it's still going to be the game experience that's going to sell this.
Yeah, but right? It's Nintendo. That's what they're all about, the game.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Right?
Like, it's like the value is not necessarily in the building, but it's in the cost effectiveness of what the building brings to it. In that you get multiple experiences for one flat rate, as opposed to them having to make five high-end experiences with five expensive accessories.
I kind of disagree. I mean, this is definitely designed for... It feels like something that's designed more for kids than it is for adults. Let's get that out of the way.
Okay.
And I don't think you need to build it with your kid, because it actually helps you build it. They have a walkthrough for every single step.
Got it.
Animated.
I'm sure there's different levels based off of ages and stuff. But like, the market is saturated with, like, different STEM toys right now. That is, like, build this, and then it sits on your shelf and doesn't do anything. The fact that this is build it and it integrates into another piece of hardware that is already in your life, I think that's fascinating. And what I'm really interested in is whether or not they're going to open up a community to make your own design.
So that's my question, is how customizable are these and how open could it be? The designs themselves, like, they're selling the software. That's not going to be open no matter what.
Like the Mario Maker version of Labo.
But, you know, like, Nintendo last year, the second story beyond the Switch is how easily some of their products got hacked, right? So somebody's going to come out with an open version of this.
So, Jeremy, as someone who, like, 3D prints and laser cuts, are you inclined to take these Labo designs, and would it be more interesting to you to modify them so that you could be 3D printing and laser cutting more robust accessories?
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. Because that's one concern of mine. Like, this does raise concerns.
The robustness of the cardboard.
A lot of things that kids buy, they get thrown into a drawer or on top of a shelf or on the floor and stepped on. These aren't going to last long with that kind of care.
So I like that. I totally dig that. And I dig the idea that if designs, not exactly the cardboard designs, but if the community then builds up so that people who have access to 3D printers and laser cutters can be making their own accessories, that's way more interesting to me than kids putting stickers on their cardboard, you know, cardboard keyboards.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be fun. I mean, it'd be fun to see what you could do to augment it, maybe even use the games in different ways. There's an RC car, for instance.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see if you could make a faster car and then do races with your friends.
It's not difficult to imagine to turn that keyboard into a guitar.
Yeah.
And have the same functionality, except you would have your own stem.
How has the word pinball not been uttered from you?
Yeah, no,
that would be very interesting. I would think.
Somebody actually used the Switch, because you can there's pinball games on the Switch, and somebody used it to make one of those digital pinball machines. And they used the Joy-Cons on the sides for the flippers. So it's just all right there, and they connected to a TV, just strapped it underneath. Nice.
Now, the robot one is its own kit, and that's like a singular experience. Yeah. You become a robot.
That's
and
more,
so that
a more
encourages
complicated kit.
Play, right? Encourages, like, this is the next level, using your imagination, augmenting what's just beyond what's just on the screen itself. Do you guys feel like that's going to be compelling?
I want to play it. I want to build it. I am more interested in how these things work than playing them. But I know it's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be a fun little game to play.
I'm a little less interested in the robot kit than the variety kit, just because of how extensible the variety kit seems.
Yeah.
The robot kit feels like one of those things where it'll integrate super well with one game. You build it, you play it a few times. Then you're wearing this uncomfortable cardboard thing, and you probably put it down, and you don't use it that much anymore. That's my concern about the robot kit. But like Jeremy says, who cares? I want to build it.
Yeah, you've seen the video, like the mm-hmm. robot kit. You open up the back, and there's these things sliding around, caused by your arms moving.
Yep.
It's a real Pacific Rim kind of experience.
Yeah, right.
And he's wearing a visor, but I don't think that actually does anything.
I think that's decoration.
I think you're playing something on the TV.
Got it. So it's not multiplayer. You're not playing against someone else who's wearing a robot suit.
I don't know.
That'd be cool.
If that happened, that would be killer.
Yeah, so I don't know. So the five games in the variety kit are RC cars, fishing. There's a house, and I don't know what that does. But there's also a motorbike game and this piano. And the piano's the one I just can't wait to see how that thing works.
Well, it's coming out sooner. Relatively soon, mid-April. So maybe GDC, we'll see some hints of it. That might be a good time.
I suspect Nintendo's going to end up at non-gaming events.
Maker Faire is May, so it'll be post-release.
It'll be post-release, but I think if they go to places like that, that might emphasize we're here to, you know, open this up to a larger community, not just...
Dude, if they did a Mario Maker version of this, man, I don't see them doing that. I don't see, because they would really have to, like, provide some kind of game-making thing. That would be the software they sell, but then they'd have to let people...
I don't think that's going to come at launch.
No,
but
no,
if it's successful,
that would be so cool. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you think it's a seller for Switch, like people who haven't bought Switch yet, or is it that's still Odyssey and Breath of the Wild?
I don't think so. I think it's the other way around. Yeah. I think it enhances your Switch purchase.
All right, so it's getting people. It's a physical killer app for first half of this year.
I will say, as somebody that doesn't have the Switch, this made me more interested in the Switch. I'm not going to buy the Switch because of this, but like. This is just an incredible feature.
Exactly. This turns parents on. This is the kind of game that turns
justifying,
parents on.
Justifying, yeah. Well, I bought this kid the Switch.
All he's doing is playing video games.
All he's playing is playing that Mario Odyssey. Now, let's get him some cardboard and
can build. Now he's going to go into a STEM career because of these cardboard add-ons.
Yeah. Thanks, Nintendo.
I think 1 year later we'll have a lot more to say about the potential of this platform once it's actually out and what people are doing with it. I'm hopeful.
We're fine. That's too low. Norm has adjusted the audio.
Yeah. We have, we're in awards season right now. The Golden Globes are over, and we have the Academy Awards around the corner, and we had some nominations, including, I think... maybe some reactionary nominations from some snubs at the Golden Globes.
Oh, looky. Was that casting a little shade?
No, some of the reactions?
Because
snubs every year.
I was sort of thrilled. Like, we had our little, me, Jeremy, and Mike Micah had our review of some of our favorite things of 2017, including movies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about the Golden Globes is, like, my favorite movie of last year, which was Get Out, partially because it came out of nowhere, really got left out of the Golden Globes. And in the Oscar noms, it's both in the Best Picture and Best Directing category.
Well-deserved.
I think the Jordan Peele Best Directing category is the one that is spot on, just because when you I don't know, have you rewatched that movie?
I haven't watched it the first time.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, you got to watch it.
Even on a rewatch, horror movies usually don't do well on rewatch because you know the story. You know what's going to happen. There isn't anything to relive through. On the rewatch, I felt like there was another level of depth, another level of like social commentary they were getting. That speaks to incredible directing.
I really don't care about the best picture. I think you're right. It's the best director. That's going to be the most competitive category this year because we have Jordan Peele, who is so well-deserved and in terms of writing and directing, Get Out, and you also have Guillermo del Toro, who is incredibly well deserved in writing and directing Shape of Water,
and he won the directing award
exactly.
at the Golden Globes.
So he's technically, if you do your pool Oscar pool, he's the one to beat. And then you also have for his first Best Director nomination, Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, which I thought was an amazing film from last year. A little more of a traditional nomination, but. His first nomination, so
it's one of those directors,
highly competitive.
Christopher Nolan's one of those directors that people will look at and say, he's made so many good movies. I want to give him an award.
You could say the same about Guillermo del Toro.
I don't think Christopher Nolan's going to win for Dunkirk. There just isn't the love of that movie, even though it was, I finally did see it. It was visually spectacular. And it's probably one of the more intricate, technically challenging movies that was made last year. But I don't hear that kind of love of that movie that's going to carry it to victory. I was happy to see Greta Gerwig get something for Lady Bird, which was probably my favorite sort of non-horror, non-comedy movie of last
year. Still haven't seen it, but I completely acknowledge that since that movie has been so well reviewed, second only to Paddington 2 as the best reviewed movie on Rotten Tomatoes. Also, no nomination for, no acknowledgement for Wonder Woman, Patty Jenkins and the achievements of Wonder Woman.
You know, we talked about that briefly, and Wonder Woman was a great movie, but it was partially great because of how bad DC movies had been. Like, it was like the Phoenix rising out of the garbage.
I think that's unfair. No, I think it was great because it fulfilled so much of it met the expectations, the very high expectations. I don't think low expectations because of DC movies, because high expectations of the character.
Oh yeah, I mean, I thought the last act, the climactic act, left a lot to be desired in both how it looked and the dialogue and everything else. And that's why I have a hard time saying Wonder Woman in the same category of some of these other movies, which are really polished. Shape of Water, especially.
So the only director you didn't mention who's nominated is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, yes. And
I haven't seen it.
I haven't either. Phantom Thread is the new film. I really don't have any interest. I like immature Paul Thomas Anderson so much more than mature Paul Thomas Anderson. Magnolia was great. You know, Punch Drunk Love was probably my last favorite movie of his.
They're showing it in 70mm at the Alamo Drafthouse, and I was there the other night for my event, and it had just let out a screening, and people were really thrilled with it. But I have the same feeling. It feels like a slog to me.
It's all his new movies. They're just so contemplative. Give me more Boogie Nights.
The Big Sick, nominated for Best Original Screenplay for Emily B. Gordon and Kumail Nanjiani. That was great. I think it's going to be competitive. I think the thing that we get lost up in or get caught up in is trying to pick the best of the best when the nomination should say, hey, there were a lot of great films this year, and if you're a fan of film, you not necessarily watch all of these yet, go out and watch some films. I think that's what the nominations
are. What was your favorite movie of last year? You saw more stuff than us.
Oh, I haven't seen enough. I haven't seen Lady Bird. I haven't seen... I'm just looking at the best picture list, right? I haven't seen Darkest Hour, haven't seen Phantom Thread, haven't seen The Post, haven't seen Three Billboards. Like, it tells me that I need to watch more of these films. I really love The Shape of Water. I don't necessarily think it's the best movie I even saw last year. Like, I like Dunkirk more than The Shape of Water.
Wow.
There you go.
But everyone has their different tastes, right? It's just a matter of preference. Same with Get Out. I like that more than Shape of Water, too. But Shape of Water did have 13 nominations. Which I don't know if that's a record-breaking number of nominations, but it's very high. Consensus feels like, and it's so, the Oscar thing is so, I'm going to say political, but it's so affected by timing, right? And
Shakespeare in Love, anyone? Yes.
Yeah, when the movies are released.
I love that movie. What are
you talking about? Shakespeare in Love is great, but it beat Saving Private Ryan.
For best movie that year, yeah. Which many, many claim was a... undeserved win. I like both those movies. I think timing matters so much. I think there's also this feeling of, I don't know exactly when the ballots are cast, but there's this feeling of responding to other award ceremonies, right? So, like, there's a whole temporal aspect that gets put into account that, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the line, gets all that context is gone, and all the people remember is that name next to that year as best picture or best director.
At the end of the day, the awards don't mean much. I mean, this seems like a really good year for movies.
Yeah.
And a diverse set of movies. They aren't all like, Shape of Water is not your typical Oscar movie. and Get Out, not your typical Oscar movie. So I think that's the other thing.
A monster movie and a thriller.
A monster rom-com and a horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's the genre for the upcoming potential movie Duke Nukem, starring John Cena.
You're kidding, right?
Monster rom-com,
oh my God,
and horror thriller. Why does this movie need to be made?
Wait. John Cena is Duke Nukem?
That's the headline. Right. It's I don't think that's it's confirmed.
That's excellent casting.
It is.
For the character.
I 100% concede that that's amazing casting, but the apparently it's going to be produced by Michael Bay is what the
report. Of course it is.
But I don't think anyone was really asking for this movie. And yep. It's such a dated character and a dated story. I don't think this movie could be taken.
Oh,
yeah, that is you. I don't know why it was greenlit. Like all it does is give us, you know, we just remember the vaporware that was Duke Nukem Forever, and when it was rental release, it wasn't any good.
Does Duke Nukem say anything back in those games?
Yeah, or just, he has the one liners.
He just grunts.
It's all the Arnold one liners.
Oh yes, that's
no,
right.
No. It's Ash from Evil Dead.
Yeah, and I don't mean it's actually on it, but it reminds you of, you know, Terminator 2 one-liner.
Was it Bruce Campbell's voice?
No. He was taking those lines. He was taking from They Live.
Yeah.
A lot of those lines. So it's 80s and 90s action films. Now, I know you can... I'm not saying like you can't be... You can't make a meta film. Like 21 Jump Street, I thought was amazing. A very self-aware film, right? That poked fun at its origins. But if they do this movie, I can't imagine being taken seriously. And even if they are making a self-aware, more comedic bent on this film, I think that the time has passed for this character.
Well, then I'm going to one-up you. So, because Ryan Reynolds just re-upped with Fox, and this is really about Deadpool, but he's in talks to adapt Clue and reboot it. No
as
interest.
Who? As who? As the butler?
I have no information on casting or anything else like that.
But I think okay.
Clue is not a movie that needs to be redone.
Go ahead, Jerry.
That would make an interesting series, like a television series, kind of like, you know, not a serialized thing, but every episode there was a new mystery.
Not a serialized.
No, because I don't want to see the same people. No, I want an all new mystery every single episode.
Oh,
same
I see house, what you're saying.
Same house, different mystery. Anthology series.
Sure, maybe it's a hotel.
There is a lot of murders happening in that
yeah,
house.
Yeah, people keep coming.
Set dressed differently, different era, murder every decade. If they do it, and you guys have both seen the original Clue film.
Flames down the side of my face.
You know, I think I might remember the VHS game more than the film.
The film had multiple endings. It was famous for having four or five endings. It was a farce. And if they were going to make a film that was self-aware, that maybe even broke the fourth wall a little bit, I think Ryan Reynolds would be appropriate for that.
I don't know. I like that movie so much just because of how unique it is. I don't think it needs to be remade.
Most movies don't need to be remade, but there are going to be anyway. I'm going to go with one more thing in our pop culture news. It was announced that What We Do in the Shadows, going back to popular movie in New Zealand, director of Thor, director of Hunt for the Wilder People, Taika Waititi, I want to say his name is. He's not directing it, but there are actually three projects in the works for What We Do in the Shadows. I think FX just picked up a reboot, American series reboot, American interpretation of it. And they're also doing a werewolf spinoff in New Zealand, and I believe a spinoff with the cop characters in New Zealand. So if you love that universe, and if you haven't seen that film, you can watch the film. It's amazing. It's hilarious. But that world is about to get dive into. And that is a perfect farcical comedy about vampires.
Could a new Duke Nukem movie be hinting towards the release of another video game?
Like a secret in development video game?
Like they wouldn't announce it in order to avoid all the perils that they hit last time. They would wait till it's ready.
So Take-Two, I think, has the rights to it. Which of their development teams, like what game, if no one had the rights and it was like, which developer would you want? Like it would be like, didn't we have that in kind of the Wolfenstein game? The last Wolfenstein game, right? Mm-hmm. If that set in 90s era, like 80s and 90s nostalgia, right? Like that's the kind of game it would have to be.
That would be interesting.
That's so much money though, because we got Doom the movie and no new Doom game wasn't tied to the movie, even though the Doom game was in the works.
Just an idea.
You think Duke Nukem has that type of a cultural relevance?
No. They're making a movie. I'm just wondering, why would a movie studio sign up for this? Maybe they would say, there's a game in development, unannounced, big budget, it's going to be a big deal. That'll help promote the movie. Let's do the movie.
No, this feels like people walking in a room, you know what the hottest trend is? Nostalgia. Let's buy up every nostalgic thing. And they're like on item 43 on the list, and they're like Duke Nukem.
And they may be making an association that like Tomb Raider, there's a movie coming out, but that one was based on a more recent reboot and not the 90s era Lara Croft that we already had several movies about. So that
video game also lends itself to a movie story.
Yeah.
Duke Nukem.
Yes. And then also maybe John Cena's, his agent or whoever, and him fitting the mold of a Duke Nukem character. He's a good actor. He definitely looks the part, and he could do comedy and action. So maybe that's why all this comes together. So I go away for 2 weeks and come back, and the world has changed.
Yep, now, more cashiers.
Grocery stores are cashierless, and you can just walk in, pick up the food you want, and walk out. Is that how it's working now?
It seems that way if you live in Seattle. Amazon Go opened. It's not a huge store. Let's get this off the bat. It's not a full grocery store. It's more akin to like a 7-Eleven convenience mart than it is a full-size grocery store. You have to download an app. You scan it as you walk in. There's sort of like
what do you mean you scan it?
You a barcode comes up on your phone from the app. You scan it in this like turnstile area. It lets you in, and then you're free to pick up whatever you want from the shelves and walk out.
But you scan everything you pick up?
Nope.
So how does it work?
It just knows by all of the cameras in the ceiling.
No way.
Oh,
yeah. We talked about this last year that they were going to do this. This is they use that sort of imaging technology to understand who you are based off of, you know, scanning the app. It must do like some sort of recognition of you at that point, and then tracks your movements and sees when you pull items off the shelf.
I don't believe
so. Basically, what I need to do is drive to a grocery store, Amazon Go parking lot, and find the pinstripe shirt the crosshatch shirt and Patagonia vest that a local Silicon investor the uniform for startup founders, and then watch one go into the store and then dress like them, put on a hat, and get caught and just have it charged on their bill.
So this is, I think, why you're a tech journalist, because that's basically what tech journalists have been trying to do, is seeing if they can break the store.
Right.
And there was one journalist, I'm forgetting his name, from, I believe it was The Verge, that did something interesting. So he went and just did like a full run through that morning, bought some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously very dependent on items being in specified locations.
Sure.
Right? That otherwise the system kind of starts to break down.
And recognizable.
Yeah, well, yes. But I mean, if you start moving stuff around and
shelves don't do some inventory tracking themselves?
No, they seem to. But the fact is like, you know, Tabasco is going to be there and milk is going to be here.
Got it.
And like it doesn't easily adapt. But anyways, made some purchases, left, tried to do stuff like pulled it off the shelf, looked at it,
put it back, yep.
You know, like move stuff around, like tried to create interference for the camera, all that kind of stuff. But then he did something interesting.
Wait, how did that perform though?
Perfectly. He couldn't break it.
Wow. Okay. Impressive.
And he describes the experience going to there's an alcohol section too. And there has to be a physical human there because of the laws in the state that check your IDs, and then you're free to do whatever at that point. But what he did was interesting that I thought would break it. So he buys something, leaves, comes back in, he buys a can of Coke, leaves, comes back in with it open and drinking it.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's back in the store with an item from that store.
Right.
But he previously bought it and tried to break it that way. Because now you're walking out with an item that's in the store, but you already paid for it. It still didn't get that wrong. I thought that was an interesting use case to try to break it.
I feel like that makes sense because there was no action of putting an item. The items individually, I assume, are not tagged in any way. That would be extremely expensive inventory-wise. But it didn't track him putting the item back on the shelf and take the action of taking it off the shelf.
Sure, but I mean, you imagine that's an edge use case, right? So that's where this would break. There are reports, like I think the CNBC reporter didn't get charged for yogurt they took. But by and large, people are really impressed with it. And right now, it's staffed up with a lot of people trying to explain to you how to like scan your app and get in there. And then there's a lot of commentary about how many cameras, how wired this mart is.
Of course.
There's a million cameras
in
that.
It's so expensive.
There's literally hundreds.
Yeah.
Right? That's amazing.
And the processing power that it takes to do that computation in real time, like, it's throwing so much money.
Sensor fusion.
And of course, they're getting all the data, right? They can optimize traffic patterns. They can optimize inventory. They can optimize sales automatically even, without people running it. But
well, the optimization is going to be moving items around the store. That's right. Going to take
people. Yeah. Like the shelves don't automatically like shift,
right.
But they could in the future, right? What does Amazon care about this data? Why do they care about what individuals? I mean.
I think there's two ways to look at it. You can look at it cynically. They own Whole Foods, and you could say, down the road, is this a way to eliminate employees at Whole Foods and go for a full automation play? I don't think that's what it is, because that Whole Foods environment is so much more complicated than this sort of a situation. But now they have you... they have shopping habits and they can sell exclusive merchandise to you. So I think that gives them a benefit on the back end. Retailers are going to come to them and say, hey, sell this exclusively in these automated stores. Two, it gets to suggest items to you even more. So the data becomes even more powerful.
Well, it's tied into all their other things. Like they have, they have the Echo and Alexa, right? And people were making shopping lists with that. Now they know exactly what you bought. That information can be activated some way in your home with those devices.
And it is potentially cheaper. I know there's a lot of upfront costs here, but it is in the long run much cheaper.
But then you're not employing people.
But
yes, that's right. No, I'm not saying it's a good thing for the community, but it is cheaper.
I think what's interesting is when you look at like the ecosystem where you buy stuff, like they've started to dominate electronics and home goods and all of these things, and now we made a foray into grocery stores. The last vestige of that is convenience stores. And we've seen the
pop-up
autonomous bodega, right?
Yeah.
That came out at CES that looks ridiculous. But I think they're all trying to attack this market of people walking down the street and being like, I need a pack of gum, or like I want a coffee or a soda or something. And attacking that 7-Eleven corner store market is a place Amazon hasn't been before. And I think that's really what they're trying to do.
Man, it's that delicious breakfast octopus.
I imagine they don't do produce unless it's prepackaged in some way.
Everything seemed prepackaged. I didn't see produce.
But
in
even
the
if it is prepackaged, it's got to be by weight. So I'm not sure how they do that.
No, I think they would just do it individually. Like you would get an apple and it would be like a buck.
Mm-hmm. But what about if I got a big apple and you got a small apple? We're both paying a buck.
TS.
Oh my God.
Tough luck. Yeah. And they can, now that they know where everyone is. Right. And a lot of systems know where people are, even without people realizing it. Like when you walk through a mall, when you walk through Disneyland, they know exactly where you are. And even though it's not something that they may be transparent about or something that they may take action on, now Amazon has the data and they can take action in the store with surprise discount just for you by looking at this label. If you've been hovering at that aisle, indecisive, what about slash the price on two of these things and you get to buy both?
Yeah, you start to walk away. They're like,
dynamic,
but wait,
the lights will change.
Dynamic pricing. Well, so if you were walking down the street and the Amazon Go store and a 7-Eleven, a generic convenience store, and you needed just something from the bag of chips and a soda, where would you go?
There are the three things I would consider. One, inventory, so the place that's going to have the thing I want. Two, pricing, and three, wait times, convenience.
For me, the third one is the biggest.
And everyone's going to value those things differently.
You go to a grocery store after work, and you're signing up for a line that's going to last 15 minutes in a city anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no line here. I can't imagine there will ever be a line.
As long, I mean, there's going to be the only line is potentially the swipe in.
There's no the takes no check time. In. Takes no time.
No, but I mean, there's a learning curve. People like bringing it up on the app.
Computational capacity right now. Our computers can only track 100 people at a time.
That's interesting.
So you got to wait until two people leave before you can come in.
Maybe that's the line.
Could be. I mean, it's a small store, so I imagine they might be like, oh, you can't. We can't fit any more people in here.
Wow. Hmm. That's really interesting.
They haven't said whether they're going to take this nationwide. They definitely have said they have no plans to put this in Whole Foods. I think the infrastructure changes would be extremely expensive.
Yeah.
But it may be something that will go to other stores if they can show with the data that people using this system are more likely to buy more things. Because you're not looking at prices. You're not looking at a receipt at the checkout counter, just kind of taking things and putting in your basket.
What if this is the new AWS system for physical stores? They license it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm imagining this is going to be everywhere. I mean, not tomorrow.
Not just in grocery stores. Right. Clothing stores.
Malls.
Any type
anything.
Of stores.
Anything with a ceiling.
Yeah.
Anything with a ceiling. What kind of store is that?
Well, and then you wait 5 years and you don't need to scan your phone. It's just that retina scan that they have in Minority Report.
Yeah, that just sees you walking down the aisle.
Right. Welcome back. You need your size 40 jeans?
Well, you don't need that. I mean, if Face ID is that good right now, that tech is already there.
You're right. It is.
Or just your phone reading your Bluetooth, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Sensor fusion.
Anybody tried to buy a graphics card lately?
I've tried to buy some RAM lately, and RAM is very expensive.
RAM's a little bit more expensive than it used to be. You're right. They've kind of traded places with CPU prices.
Right.
So that's kind of that's a wash. But GPU prices, holy smokes.
Well, if you can find them. Just availability.
The
prices are, it's because supply is low and because demand is very high.
Now, I guess this started mid last year.
Right.
And this all tracks to cryptocurrency mining.
Oh.
This is all about the miners.
Ooh.
And it goes back to mid last year where prices started to ramp up and you started to have to pay retail mid last year. And then they kind of came down. You could find a deal. Into December, you were lucky to get a deal on a graphics card.
Mm.
After that, forget it. You're paying right now, if you go to buy a graphics card, if you can find one, you're paying 3x retail.
Wow.
And that goes for like the top
is
cards,
that
too.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, maybe 2x, but still, you're paying over $1,000 for what should be a $500 card.
That's insane.
So the 1080 Ti is the hotness. That's the fastest NVIDIA card.
Yeah,
it's like $1,600, $1,700, and you can.
Good luck building a VR rig right now.
You can even buy them in sets of six. Like a lot of people are selling them in sets because that's what the miners want, and they're all being snapped up. And NVIDIA is finally coming out and saying to some of their partners, please try to sell to gamers.
Yeah, answer this quiz about. Video games before you can buy this card, before open my shelf.
You know what? Good on NVIDIA, because I think they see, like, these aren't return customers, really.
You know, I think NVIDIA's between a rock and a hard place, because they have the potential to make a lot of money here.
Yeah.
They're okay with that, but they also realize that there's this whole nascent industry of VR that needs a high-end graphics card, and as well as people building their own game, PC game. PC is just to play regular PC games. They all want to buy a new card.
When does Microsoft enable...
You just can't.
...cryptocurrency mining on the Xbox?
Like it's a profile that you switch to?
Yeah. So you can run your Scorpio and do some mining. That was a lot of units.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you see... There's some analysis that have started to come out on the carbon footprint of the mining.
Yeah.
31 terawatt hours per year... based on the hardware that's been bought by miners based on surveys.
Can't wait till that crash.
That means out of, there's like what, like 240 countries in the world? That is more than 150 countries' annual energy production.
Yeah, I was talking to some people about that, and there's not really a solution. Like there's a new Lightning network that launched a week ago on Bitcoin, which really speeds up transactions and lowers the dollar cost. But it doesn't solve the power problem, and there is no solution in sight for the power problem. That's just going to have to scale with renewable energies.
And what's intense is there's, like, our grid, even though it's older, is a little bit more situated to handle some of the load generation that's happening.
Mm.
But Venezuela, where they're having this huge, massive inflation of their own currency, there's been a surge in miners, and their grid isn't able to handle this. So they're having power distribution problems for people just wanting to power their homes based on miners sucking up energy.
Well, the problem is it's all speculation, and it's not people who are using this to for the belief that they're building, like, you know, currencies to improve the world. It's because the price has gone up.
It's not speculation. It is free money. I mean, if you have a GPU, if you're mining, even if you're only making a few dollars, right, it's still free money.
The electricity's got to come from somewhere.
But it's cheaper than the electricity.
Really?
There are ROI calculators that use, of course, for every coin, and you can type in your electricity costs, and you can make a few dollars. Like the ROI average for the cost of graphics cards right now is, I think, about a year and a half.
So if you spend the 3x price on retail, $1,500 on a graphics card or more, in a year and a half of mining, you will make that money back from the currency at its current growth rate.
At its current price, yes.
But the thing is that will be diminishing as more and more coins become less and less available.
Yeah, yeah, yes. But then, of course, you're trading against Bitcoin. So depending on what the price of Bitcoin is,
sure,
that could go up and maybe offset that.
The problem is that once the cards, like, they're running these cards nonstop, I assume. That's taxing the cards. It's not like if the bubble bursts and the market's flooded with these secondhand cards, there are going to be a lot of people burned with cards that maybe aren't as reliable because they've been burned out.
It's interesting because Bitcoin has been in a bear market since mid-December. It's been coming down. Mm. It's now half what it was. And yet since then, like almost since the peak of Bitcoin, the ramp for GPU prices has gone up and up and up.
What does that indicate?
It doesn't map to the drop in price.
I mean, interest and speculation and people wanting to mine is still there. But people are taking their money out and then people are losing money.
I think people are just realizing you can make money if you're patient enough. And people who buy 1080 Ti's, like, they're making, you know, they're spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
But they're also making $50 a day or something.
You think they're doing it on Bitcoin proper or all these alternative coins?
And I don't think they're doing it on Bitcoin. I think it's mostly altcoins. There's a lot of Ethereum and various other coins. If you go to these sites, you find out what your card is good at. Like, NVIDIA is different than AMD. AMD's cards are good at some things that NVIDIA isn't.
I'm shocked that that can actually affect the price of the consumer market of the hardware this way.
In a major way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a horrible time to be a PC gamer. Like, if you're building a PC right now, it's very expensive.
Well, let me give you a different idea then. What about, instead of mining yourself, what if we just buy cryptocurrency mystery boxes?
Loot boxes.
Yeah. Come on, Jeremy.
God, don't tell my son about this. What is this?
You could get 0.03 coins. You could get one coin.
So there are a couple of companies that now, and this is not something we advocate at all, but just the novelty of, they took the idea of cryptocurrency value being in flux, right? And then also the idea of the endorphin rush of buying a mystery loot box, and they're selling online random amounts of crypto that can be worth anywhere between a range of X and Y. And there's a report on The Outline. Sam Hill, the reporter, tried it and didn't make the money back. Lost money for sure.
Okay.
I believe one of the sites he references is out of business or disappeared. They, like, shut down their Twitter account after this article came out.
Yeah.
With good reason. This is just straight up gambling.
It is straight up gambling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're trusting the casino, in this case, a small company, in actually being fair in how they randomly generate and allocate what's in these loot boxes or whatever, your loot wallets, your crypto wallets. It's a little bit ridiculous. Another thing I thought was pretty ridiculous is, have you guys used Instagram or you guys use...
Well, this is the old podcast. Yeah. Yeah, we know about Instagram.
No, you guys, yes, yes. If you use Instagram or even Facebook, and have you seen those ads for, like, shoes or jackets or clothes that, like, look, or even sometimes furniture that look very stylish, from brands that you don't recognize?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that many of these clothing companies and brands are just marketing fronts for cheap products from China, from AliExpress or Alibaba. And there's a really interesting analysis, Alexis Magical wrote a story for The Lancet about this, about how of this whole cottage industry of people creating fake companies, finding supply of items that they can get very cheaply in China, and then just creating very targeted marketing campaigns on Instagram using stock photos and creating a Shopify store and making very easy money in a very short period of time.
So who runs the stores? The manufacturers?
No, that's the thing. The prime example is this YouTuber, this kid, who says, okay, I'm going to show you how I can make a couple $1,000 by basically doing nothing, having no inventory, nothing. And he takes – all he's doing is connecting supply and generating demand, right? He says he knows on Alibaba, AliExpress, there are warehouses in China full of these shoes, these necklaces, or these boots or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's randomly pick one,
yeah,
right? And they could – people could be going through AliExpress and could be buying that. But one, they don't – maybe don't know about it.
Yeah.
And two, maybe it's not presented in a way that's enticing. And so what he's taking advantage of is people on Instagram or Facebook, and then creating a fake a real company, but a distributor company, just photoshopping some ads and then using plugins to buy Facebook ads that do things like pop up, oh, someone just bought this thing, only five left, or show like a photo and tap into, because Facebook and Instagram know exactly what type of things you're browsing.
And so, he accepts the credit card transactions? And takes a cut and pushes it and just pushes it as a transaction directly to the manufacturer.
Exactly. And then they will do all the fulfillment.
Yeah.
And he gets his cut and he generates that demand.
So how is this so different than affiliate links?
It's because it's completely manufactured. There's nothing
behind it. I understand
there's
like a front end. Well, affiliate links, there's nothing behind it. I mean, you're just clicking through a site, right?
With affiliate links,
you're usually backed by some type of editorial.
By the actual distributor. He's taking the whole transaction.
Oh, he's taking the... It's the... Oh, that's shady.
He controls his cut.
Yeah, yeah. So he's marking up the prices then, too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
By, like, double? What are we talking about?
I don't know what it is, but it's like... It's all about presentation and how... And he says that even if people don't buy, even if they just like the link on Instagram or you know, click through, they get... There's a tracking cookie that then... populates it on, you know, on whatever network they're going to be on next on Facebook, and they'll start seeing ads. And even if you have a very small conversion rate, it's worth it for them to run these type of businesses because the ads are cheap and they're very targeted.
I admire the companies that are buying in bulk from overseas, China or where else.
Yep.
And they ship them over here to get the discount and then distribute them.
Sure, that's a very traditional way of globalization.
But that's not what he's doing.
No, this is purely tapping into social media and targeted advertising voodoo, and people are very susceptible to it because they'll scroll through their feed and maybe there's someone you know that likes a lot of fashion or likes a certain type of thing, and they'll see an ad and it looks like the ad looks good, right? The ad looks very photogenic, and it's just a stock photo, and there are all these mechanisms to compel people to click through and buy, and. You're most getting in with junk because you get what you pay for.
It's totally taking advantage of how those networks operate. I get that. And there's something skeevy about it. There's nothing illegal happening
nothing
here.
Nothing illegal.
And there's
I
nothing...
I think it's just fascinating. This is like commercialization in the modern era.
Yeah. This is what the model Jeremy just talked about as buying and distributing. This is a modern version of that.
Right. 100%. The thing that I have a problem with is the false generated demand. Right, like, I have no problem of having an ad targeted to me if it's something I'm genuinely interested in and if the quality is going to be good. And advertisers have enough information about me to push that. But if now it's all kind of spammy and it's all worthless, then it breaks down the whole system. And it's working.
Fair enough. Now I'm worried about following you on Instagram, Norm. Be getting all these push notifications for t-shirts.
Han jackets.
A couple of other rounds. Actually, I did not get... So one thing going back to being away for 2 weeks is I felt some severe FOMO about things that are announced at CES. I know you guys covered some announcements at CES, but give me the quick download and tell me, did we miss out on CES this year? Were those bendable TVs? There's
look, I mean, I think you know, based on the coverage, that CES was a mess this year with the blackout. And
oh, I that's my biggest FOMO. I missed the great blackout.
I don't know if that's a FOMO moment, because I'm not sure, based on Shannon's description of it last week, that you wanted to be there when that happened.
Chaos.
And then just how the rain affected the show itself, and like how there's leaks and, yeah, all sorts of stuff like that. She was most excited about the Vive Pro, and I think that's the number one thing that you probably wanted to try and check out that you didn't see, and there was some multiplayer stuff that came out. The company, I'm forgetting their name, that developed the wireless adapter for the Vive.
TP-Cast?
No, not TP-Cast.
The
Data Link or something. Okay. Like, they had some multiplayer VR that I think those experiences would have been totally worth it. There was a lot of car announcements that seemed interesting, but I didn't walk away from all the announcements about consumer electronics really excited about anything outside of VR yourself.
I've never been to CES. I'd like to go, but I didn't feel like this was a year that I really desperately wished I had been there. Mm. The Vive Pro is definitely the most exciting thing.
Got it.
So hopefully you will have a chance to see that. And, you know, if it doesn't have to be on the show floor, that's fine.
We will. Okay. All right. Well, there have been product announcements since then. DJI this past week announced their latest quadcopter. I'd say about time, because they were on a cadence of new products every few months and been so long since their last announcement.
What is it, like a normal length of time
since their last announcement? Exactly. So this is the Mavic Air. It's $800 quad. So now they have the Spark, which they announced in 2017. Their entry-level quad was $400.
Is it that expensive?
Yeah, Spark was, I think, overpriced a little bit. $400 for the Spark, $800 for the Mavic Air, and then $1,000 for the Mavic Pro, which was very well received, and we actually really love flying. The Mavic Air, though, seems to be more akin to the Spark than the Mavic Pro, and does have a nice camera, 4K camera, and you know, it's foldable, it's very portable. They're going under a very portable space right now. 21 minutes of flight time, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Much better than the Spark's about 15, 16 minutes.
Does it have a real controller?
So that was a big thing with the Spark and the Pro, which was like, which package do you get? And do you get a controller? And I'm not actually sure what the transmitter...
Because I have no interest
It does have a dedicated controller.
In the phone controller.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no dedicated display like the Mavic Pro has.
That's fine.
So I don't want to make this a long thing, but is DJI on the edge of just having too many SKUs right now?
I think it's more about where the quadcopter industry is going in general, because we saw this massive explosion of quad companies from... You know, Parrot to DJI to now even like Fat Shark has one, and I think the market was probably smaller than most companies expected. It's still mostly hobbyists, and even a lot of hobby companies in the U.S. started making quads, and now it became too expensive to compete. I don't know what it means internationally. I don't know how if quads are just generally more accepted internationally. But in the U.S., with some uncertainty with the regulations and registration being required, then not required, and now yes, required again, it's not a thing we see happening.
No, I mean, like, some of it makes sense to me. Like, the Phantom makes sense from where it is. The Mavic makes sense from a portability play. But now you have, like, three different in that portability play for them, and you have three different in the Phantom line, too. So it's just feeling really crowded, and the price points, the difference between the price points is shrinking as well.
Yeah.
And so it feels like where Apple is right now when you look to buy a phone. There's eight phones or whatever on sale.
Yeah, and also like the use case of using one of these for travel or for being in a rural part of the country is very different than in an urban part of the country where we are right now. So... I just don't know if it's going to be as ubiquitous as these companies hope they would be. I think there's still a lot of things to figure out in the legislation and also in the technology for safety. It grew very, very fast. I'd like to see it continue to grow because I think there's a lot of amazing things you could do. And definitely for production, we're seeing a lot of quads and multi-rotors being used for production. And the technology, I still think, feels like magic when you have stabilization and you have GPS tracking and you have amazing video footage and that being accessible to consumer. I think it's great. I just don't know if it's like they're selling a lot more Switches than they are Sparks.
I think it's been hurt by like the Christmas market of the there's so many cheap bad drones out there that you know are being sold to kids.
But we've talked about this already, but I still don't understand the difference between the Mavic Air and the Mavic Pro.
The Mavic Pro and the Mavic Air?
Yeah. It looks like the Mavic Pro has 5 more minutes of flight time.
It's battery life, and it might be the power of the rotors as well.
Okay.
Hopefully going to get a briefing to check it out.
God, that doesn't seem like a big difference.
For a $200 price point difference.
Yeah.
I mean, $200, if you're talking about 16 minutes or 21 minutes, flight time matters so much. And many people would pay for the additional flight time. It is also a year and a half now,
mm-hmm.
newer device. I had hoped that they'd just drop the price of the Pro to $800, $750. It'd be a really nice sweet spot.
All right.
Let's talk about some Apple stuff.
Yes.
Apple still hanging around? Still doing okay? Yeah?
Yeah. They're hanging on by the skin of their pants. Poor guys. Yeah, they need your money.
They're finally releasing the HomePod on in about a week and a half or so, February 9th. The HomePod will finally be released. Anyone, any interest here for HomePod?
You know, I want to hear it. I want to hear it because that's what they've got going for it. Supposedly, it's the best sounding of these speakers. But I, you know, my relationship with Siri is not good right now, so I'm not interested in that
all variations of Siri, all dialects and accents.
Yeah. So you know, that's the struggle for them. If they can fix Siri, HomePod will be great.
Now I wonder if you had the AirPods. I don't have AirPods. How well, like, if there's a way for it to seamlessly, if you're walking in your house with your AirPods on and you want to seamlessly transfer what you're listening to in your AirPods over to this, that system right now with other speakers is bad. So I'm curious what that looks like here.
So is this a replacement for soundbars for living rooms or some people's living rooms?
I mean,
soundbars. Who has soundbars in their living room?
So many people use soundbars.
You mean for their
TVs? Yeah, TV soundbars.
And you're saying they keep those on and they use those as a stereo as well?
Yeah, because it's tied to your Apple TV. Like, integration is one of their big selling points. Just like the AirPod may not be the best sounding headphones, but it's ability to be wireless, and also its highly integrated nature with iOS devices makes it compelling. Is this AirPod for your Apple TV?
I mean, you can't set up 4 of these as a surround sound system with your Apple TV. That would be cool.
Can't you? You can't do multiple?
I don't think you can do 4 channel, like 5.1 audio. That would be good.
Right. But soundbars aren't 5.1 really either.
Well, they are.
Soundbars simulate mostly 2.1.
Yeah, but you could actually have dedicated discrete speakers this way.
Yes, which most people don't. Again, the convenience of like, we're past air, and there's still, I know, a whole market for this of like copper wires through your walls and getting 7 channels in your living room. But to get mass market, it has to kind of be wireless.
Yeah.
And over Wi-Fi.
I mean, have either of you heard the Sonos, I don't know what it's called, the base station or whatever, which a lot of people rave about in my world.
The Sonos One?
Yeah, the one that like literally your TV sits on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wireless base station meant to produce that sound. I mean, it'd be really interesting to compare those two against each other.
Yeah. No, not interested. I just want to hear it. That's all. You?
If it sounds good.
You're not going to get one, right?
I'm not going to get
one.
Right. Yeah, and part of it is that integration with Siri is not a selling point for me.
Not just that. Like, I already have an Amazon speaker throughout in almost every room. Like, I got my kids the little Puck. Like, $30. You know, why wouldn't you put one of those?
Too late to the game.
In every room. Too late, and the services just aren't there yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other big Apple thing news isn't maybe even related to Apple, but there was a report by, I think it started with Apple Insider, which came from an analyst report that Apple is discontinuing the iPhone X later this year in lieu of its new products, which we expect to come out in September. But all the reporting on this, the vast majority of the reporting, reported this as Apple X failure, equal failure, Apple going to kill it in less than a year. What are you guys' takes on that?
You mean if it were true?
What if it's true? I don't think it's true at all.
I don't think it's true.
But the fact that it was reported as such.
No, it's just, I think it's clickbait. This is a headline that gets you a lot of traffic, and it's completely
There, it was clickbait that spread so quickly.
It is because like, people have been looking for a negative Apple story.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I guess people always are.
Yeah, this is true.
Is this a reaction to the pricing? That like people want the pricing model to fail, $1,000 phone.
One of the reasons they gave was apparently sales in China weren't nearly as good as they hoped.
Mm.
But ostensibly they were good here.
I think when you when you look at it, when you look at the iPhone X launch, I mean, Face ID has been a success. There's no other way around it. Like, there are things about the camera, like the portrait mode they've been selling, and emojis, people are like, whatever. But Face ID has worked and worked well, and no one else really has it.
Whoa. First of all, Face ID is a compromise. It is a compromise that has been accepted. It is not a success in that people are now happier. I don't think anybody prefers Face ID over Touch ID.
Really? I think I disagree at this point.
I think there are certain use cases in which Face ID is more convenient, most notably for password auto form fill out, right? The passive recognition.
Oh, yeah.
I think once that moves to laptops and iMacs and desktops,
yeah,
that type of sensor is powerful.
I don't think anybody was using Touch ID saying this is too slow, I'm not happy with this. I think people like the bigger screen that Touch ID supposedly is incompatible with, or at least we thought it was until CES.
Right, because now there are screens with touch sensors underneath them that work just as well, and also touch sensors on even home buttons of phones on the side that I don't know how well those work, but they work.
So my dream is that they're canceling the iPhone X because they're bringing back Touch ID like through the screen. That
I don't
know.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I doubt it. But however, you guys also said a couple weeks ago about some other topic that I was wrong about. I said that, what was it? That I wanted Apple to, I forget. It'll come.
Were you about to give us evidence that we've been wrong on this podcast? I think there's a lot of cases of that.
The reporting I thought on this, and I read it mostly from a distance, was so. I mean, I think clickbaity is a reductionist term, but I would say it's even malicious in terms of how it was reported. Like, people found delight in the way they reported it, when clearly the source of this, the context, if you have any type of context, if you add any type of context, it is not surprising that what they were selling now this year may be discontinued in lieu of a different line. Because the bottom line is the phones are still going to cost that much. They're still going to be expensive. And this might even be bigger and more expensive.
I mean, they're going to make a new phone. It was always going to be last year's phone anyway.
It's not
a big deal.
The only story is that they might not just discount the price of this phone and make it last year's phone, and they would just manufacture a new model. That's the only story, I think, here. And I think it's a distraction from the fact the real story, which is the battery life of these phones and how difficult it has been for people to get their batteries replaced on the old models. And that the battery lives on these phones, the new phone that you bought last September, may only be good for 18 months or so in regular use and repeated charging.
That was it. It was about the slowing down the phones due to the old batteries. And I said, I want Apple to put a toggle in the phones to allow me to make that decision whether or not I want my old battery to run at full speed or not.
And are they doing it?
And I'll pay the price if it does. Yes, and they're allowing that now.
It's a toggle.
No, it's not out yet, but they have said that they will do that. That they will allow the users to make that decision.
Do you think? I'll believe it when I see it, and also I think that would feed into that's going to feed into a lot of uncertainty. Like, that's going into closing apps is good for your phone when that's not the case.
I didn't think it was going to be a toggle from the Tim Cook announcement that they were just going to shut it off, like stop doing it,
stop throttling.
Yeah.
I got the impression that it was going to be something that you could
control. Wow. This is like turbo mode back in the old PC days. You want to run at 66 megahertz? Yeah. Press that button.
That's different turbo if you're plugged mode into the wall.
Now, do you think that like he went full Steve Jobs and said it through gritted teeth? He'd be like, fine, you can have a toggle.
But there's been so many class action suits against them about this.
Yeah, but usually Apple doesn't care.
I don't know.
Here's something that Apple is not going to do, as I don't believe it'll do, but I wish they would do. It's one of the reasons that being on an Android phone is interesting. Hey, it's time for HQ trivia. Sorry. Android now and the future phones will show you strength of Wi-Fi.
Yeah, this came in
and more than just an icon.
Yeah, so it came in the Android 8.1 update. And so I actually have this on my Pixel. So Pixel phones connect automatically to Wi-Fi spots and then secure it through by going through Google servers. And so, you know, I have Comcast internet. It often connects to like Comcast hotspots. But now it gives you a report on the signal strength. Basically, it's sort of download speeds. It's slow. It's not like that information comes to you instantaneously. Oh. And so the use case for this still needs to be seen. So as, you know, if you're walking down the street and connecting to this, I think the use of this is very limited. Because by the time it gives you the signal strength, you're already past.
And this is a listing of Wi-Fi, available Wi-Fi in your area.
Yeah, and it'll say stuff like, I think it's very good and good. And very good is basically at the level of where you can stream video.
And good. This is different than the typical indicator we've had, because the indicator has really been signal strength.
Yeah, and this is actually
not bandwidth.
Throughput. Yeah, this
yeah.
is bandwidth.
Wow. And you want both. You want a combination of good strength, reliability, and also good throughput. And sometimes the throughput won't even register because you can only tap into that after you've clicked the checkbox and agree to terms of use.
They haven't said how they're actually doing this, and I think that would be interesting. Like, they must be...
Well, they're
sending packets.
That's
right?
The thing. Like, you can't test the bandwidth without using it. So, yeah. Is it using your bandwidth while testing it and using up your battery?
Well, I mean, it's somebody's Wi-Fi, right? So it's hard to tell. I haven't seen an analysis where they actually mapped battery life while I was doing this. But it's toggling on and off Wi-Fi at that point, and so it's hard to probably disassociate the power consumption of Wi-Fi being on versus the bandwidth used.
Going back to something that did probably the biggest news at CES was the malware, right? Spectre and on
that
Intel chips.
Analysis.
It was addressed.
It
at
came
CES.
Up a week beforehand, but
right.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're now seeing. I mean, everyone's here has updated the firmwares on their motherboards and their CPUs.
Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Maybe you shouldn't have.
Maybe you shouldn't have, because on some Intel chips, on Haswell and Broadwell chips, you might be encountering a reboot issue.
Yeah,
which Intel has acknowledged, and I don't know. I haven't seen it on my computer yet. Have either of you?
No. I actually just got the fall creators update. I'm not even sure I'm patched.
Uh-oh.
But you know, maybe that's a good thing. Like apparently, Patrick Norton was seeing a lot of blue screens. Not even blue screens, like pink screens, like he'd never seen before. And his computer was just rebooting. Intel sent out a message to everybody, all of their, mm-hmm. you know, partners and all their consumers, saying, hold off on our patches because there seems to be a problem with disabling this functionality.
Wow. One last bit of tech news in terms of the scary future that we live in, especially in the Bay Area where we're getting an increasing number of self-driving cars. San Francisco CHP pulled over a drunk driver.
I've been waiting for this story.
Of a Tesla whose excuse for drunk driving was that the car was driving in autopilot. It was driving itself.
Well, that was his. That's why it was driving erratically? Or?
So he was on the Bay Bridge, and the car was stopped when the cops found him. And he was drunk and somewhat passed out at the wheel.
God.
So this is, like, very dangerous,
yeah.
right? But he had said he had put the car in autopilot.
Uh-huh.
And then got behind the wheel drunk. Okay, so he should totally be arrested, right?
Yep.
No question about that. But this is starting to get to that bleeding edge case of liability.
You know, when we get to level 5 autopilot, then it's fine. But we are not there yet.
No, I totally yeah. realize that. And I think every court is going to reject this idea, but they're going to have to start addressing it. Saying, like, people already blaming autopilot for doing X, Y, or Z.
Mm.
Well, also, people are, I mean, you say level 5 because you understand the tiers of automation for driving. There are definitely some people who buy these cars, and despite all the warnings that pop up, they assume it just drives itself and can stop at stoplights and can do all the smart things that they've seen in TV shows and movies.
I don't know if the people buying the cars assume that.
Maybe people who are driving the cars that they've loaned to drive the cars.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. On Monday, we had another Tesla crash, right? Like into a fire truck.
Oh, I didn't hear about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, in Culver City. The car buried itself under... Oh, my God. This is. I'll show you guys a photo. Culver City, California.
Oh.
Went right into the bottom of a fire truck. Yeah. Imperfect systems. This is why even if you have any type of autopilot system, if you're a Tesla owner, I mean, you know, don't fall asleep at the wheel. Don't drink and keep your hands on the steering wheel. Be alert. This is scary. It's scary because having done autopilot, I can see myself. I can see what a slippery slope it would be to being lax, to feeling relaxed because you're not required to pay attention full time.
Were you here when we discussed all of the people working on autopilot? I don't think you were.
No.
So there's a chart. There's a third party that creates that's been doing a chart and tracking this for years now, and they rate every company that's working on autopilot based on the performance of how well they're doing and how well they can scale. Tesla's way at the bottom.
Whoa.
Just because they apparently don't have all of the redundant systems that the other manufacturers are incorporating.
Also, there was a thing about the fact that, yeah, LiDAR.
Because they're using camera systems and not LiDAR. They're using computer vision.
Yeah, and they don't have a way to clean their sensors automatically, things like that.
Mm. All right. Well, that does it for technology news. Before we move on to our next segment, I want to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, and that's Casper Mattresses. Casper is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. They have three mattress models, original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential, and the Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Not to mention, the breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulate your body temperature throughout the night. It's delivered right to your door in a small, how-they-do-it-size box with free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. And the best part is that you can be sure your purchase is the right one with 100 nights risk-free sleep-on-it trial. After all, you spend a third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. We got a Casper a couple years ago, took that box in, opened it up, and it kind of just unfolded and turned alive. It was really cool. You can start sleeping ahead of the curve with Casper. Get $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/test and using test at checkout. Again, that's casper.com/test with the offer code test for $50 off the mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply.
Time for a moment of science.
Four stories this week, and we'll go through them pretty quickly. Sadly, the Google Lunar Prize.
I love that movie, Goonies. That's good.
The Google Lunar X Prize is ending at the end of March. This was established, I think, in 2007, a $20 million prize for a team that could launch a lunar lander and literally moonshot it and get it onto the moon and operational. There's been five finalists for a number of years. There's a number of extensions given to them. But at this point, none of these teams seem like they're close to actually initiating a launch. I think it's up to a $30 million prize now, will go away at the end of March, which is too bad because I think there was a lot of hope, especially from the founder, Peter Diamandis, that these kind of prizes would really spur a level of innovation. And I think they probably have on some level. But not the kind of success that I think they were initially looking for. All right. Biggest news story of the week in science is that Chinese scientists came out today as we're recording this and announced that they have cloned a primate using the same technique that was used to clone Dolly the sheep. And that was decades ago.
That was 20 years ago or something.
Yeah, Dolly the sheep. Dolly the sheep was cloned by something called a somatic cell nuclear transfer, where they literally take the nucleus out of an egg that, you know, contains its DNA and inserts it into another cell and implants that in a host and then grows it. But for some reason, and there's lots of explanations why, primates have been resistant to this. They were able, using a couple new techniques about sort of encouraging the fertilization, were able to grow two monkeys. They cloned two monkeys. They're little baby monkeys right now. And it was successful. They're hopeful that this will lead to some new efforts in the fight against cancer. But I think it's just an achievement unto itself that we're able to actually clone primates. They obviously came out with statements saying that they're not going to clone humans. They're not going to clone humans. But I think it's a wonderful achievement.
But the monkey is alive and...
Yeah, there's pictures of the monkey. They showed off the two monkeys that were cloned this way at the Chinese National Academy of Sciences. just this morning.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. All right, two more stories. Do you ever hear about cloud seeding efforts that the Army used to run? Army and Air Force used to run in the 40s. There's this idea that we could drop items in big storms off the coast, like either little particles or chemicals that would force the storm to dump out its rain or precipitation at that moment. So we could control when it rains, you know, when it snows.
Back to the Future too.
Big problems with this, mostly because it didn't work. And there's actually a famous story of them seeding a cloud off the Atlantic coast, and then wind shifted and the storm turned back inland and flooded some coastal areas in Florida and Georgia. But
sorry.
So this is largely regarded as an area that's been dead for a number of years. A group has been testing the technology again in Idaho under controlled conditions with support from the National Science Foundation. And they're able to create these... they're able to take something from the lab where they use miniaturized clouds, embedded them with some silver iodide that they implanted, and to actually force some precipitation. And then they scaled it up in Idaho, actually did this. So within a specified temperature range, about 0 degrees to minus 15 C, they're able to let these silver iodide particles fall into the cloud. They would crystallize, and as they crystallized, they created these sort of sites for the precipitation to accumulate, and then it started raining or snowing.
Well, so what's the difference between the mistake in that one? It's just what direction the wind was going.
Well, I mean, yeah, because if you seed a cloud and then it goes somewhere and creates problems, like who's liable for that now?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So they were actually able to make it snow in Idaho, though.
That's snow, neat.
Which I think it's just fascinating.
Geostorm.
And one last one, there's something called reactionware in drug development. This is the idea that you can create vessels that have catalysts in them and introduce some reactions in them and sort of slowly, if you chain them together, actually create compounds and do filtering all in one step instead of doing multiple steps where there's a lot of handling and stuff. There has been a set of researchers that have been looking at 3D printing reactionware. So you can create enclosed systems again with 3D printing with certain catalysts embedded in the 3D print to actually achieve this effect, because then it's sort of repeatable, it's shareable because it's now sort of a print system, and it's a little bit more robust. It worked for the first time. So technically, Jeremy,
mm-hmm.
we could print out a reaction thing and synthesize some compounds that are part of a drug development system.
Like what kind of drug are you thinking?
Well, these are all like precursors to making various drugs. People are, you know, there's always naysayers. They're saying this lowers the barrier for, you know, synthesizing dangerous drugs. I totally want to try this out if we can, mm-hmm. Under controlled conditions. I don't think we'll be able to, because most of the catalysts are not going to sell to us. But
even to you, you're well connected.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure not. But
who could we get to test them?
I think it's fascinating that you can use. I never thought about this as a use case for a 3D printer, is actually doing legitimate drug development and using what you print as an active location for reactions to happen.
There's been so many leaps in what you can test at home. Now the future will be treating at home.
Yeah, I mean, there's huge hurdles here. There's no guidance on the FDA whether they think this will actually work or not. I think the biggest thing is this lowers the cost. Like, there are reactionware kits out there that you can just sort of buy and build, but they tend to be really expensive. So being able to print it yourself, like glassware that you can sort of put together.
Seems like convenience and speed is a big part.
Yeah, also if you need to adapt here or there, adapt steps, this is, adapting a print file and doing it that way seems a lot faster. Mm-hmm. That's it for a Moment of Science this week.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
Never gets old.
It's good to be back.
So we have not yet got our hands on time with the Vive Pro. That's something we're hopefully going to be changing in the very short future. There were a bunch of VR things that happened at CES. We saw, you know, I'm sure you guys talked about wireless systems, TV cast.
Yep.
A lot of questions. I think more questions that came out of that than answers.
Are you excited about the TP Cast? As a TP Cast owner, now you'll be able to get full voice and it's smaller, you know.
The updates, no router. Well, as long as I can do it without having to buy a new one.
Well, you might have to buy a new one.
So that's the problem.
Yeah.
And 2.0, having all that functionality is, I think, essential, which goes to what we were saying with the first TP Cast, which it felt like a in progress, you know, product that was really for people who want to be early adopters. Mm-hmm. So,
not unlike VR,
much like exactly, and it worked, you know, with a bit of fiddling. So hopefully, I'm most hoping for those systems to be more reliable. I don't really mind about the clunky physical setup, but just reliability. And so you're spending more time in the experiences and less doing any setup or troubleshooting. If you're looking to get in VR in the first place, though, there is a sale on Windows Mixed Reality headsets.
Hot diggity!
50% off means like you can get the headset and the controllers for $220.
I'm actually surprised that they can make money at this level.
I mean, I don't think they were ever making money.
Is this like it's not selling well, we're just selling off inventory situation?
Yeah, and I don't know what it means for Windows Mixed Reality. I don't think it means that their foray into it is completely dead, that Microsoft is abandoning VR, mixed reality, and AR at all. I think that they need to take a step back and say, well, maybe they didn't invest enough in launching something as a more complete platform, and these headsets were all too similar, and they need to do something, like be really wholehearted if they're going to actually jump into it. But they work, and they work as Steam VR. You can play vast majority of the Steam games with these headsets, and at $200 for plus tax for a headset and controllers, that's a steal.
Yeah, the setup is super simple too because there's no sensors.
Yeah,
it's all inside out. Now, Samsung is not on
the Odyssey. Is not. That's still $500, I believe, and because you have the OLED screen and
slightly higher res screen.
Slightly higher res. It makes it interesting for the Oculus Go coming out, you know, sometime hopefully in the next couple months, because that's supposed to be about $200, and you can get something with 6 degrees of tracking and track motion controls. Yeah, it's not completely the same because one is completely mobile.
Yeah.
But if you have a gaming laptop, for example, a Windows Mixed Reality headset that has it on your gaming laptop with multiple, with, you know, a USB 3 and an HDMI out, is a great solution to get into VR right now.
Yeah, I think it's two different tracks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
But they certainly complement each other. You can now get both for $400.
Oh my God.
Well, you will be able to.
That's insane. Yeah. Any other things you want to talk about in VR?
Wait, what about the? You touched upon it last week. There was the latency that was showing up in some of the wireless VR, like the 1 millisecond.
I don't know. I read one report of somebody who noticed a little bit of latency in the, I think it was the Vive Pro wireless, the first party thing. Where he didn't have any equipment, he couldn't test it, but he just felt that he could sense a clear bit of latency that maybe most people wouldn't notice, but would feel, you know, just a little bit of maybe a nausea. However, it was at CES.
Yeah.
Who can say?
Right.
So once those come out, it'll be fun to test those. Just one little bit of news I found interesting was that Oculus has created a new measure of time.
Of course.
Which called the Flick. Mm-hmm. Named after the star of A Bug's Life. It is one.
Was it really?
No. It is 1,705.6 millionth of a second.
Mm-hmm.
So that's impressive. That is a low measure of time. And the whole point was they were trying to measure time in terms of the latency, motion to photons, and there's always a fraction left over. So they wanted a unit for which they could always have a nice round number.
For multiple different refresh rates and
frame rates and
frame rates, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they said this works for anything, even very ultra fast frame rates, and even low frame rates.
Even works for some audio sampling too, on most common audio situations. So they needed a number that was greater than a nanosecond.
Yeah.
That
they're big on integers, those mathematicians. They love their whole numbers. So the single frame, for instance, a 90 frames per second. a single frame takes up 7,840,000 flicks.
There you go. One last bit is at London Toy Fair, the company Kinects is releasing an accessory to their roller coaster model. You can use Kinects or like Lego Technic, and you can build, you know, a roller coaster. And they have a camera system that then sends a signal to a set of 3-degree of freedom VR headsets, so you can ride your toy roller coaster in VR. I like this idea.
You build it and you can ride it.
You build your roller coaster.
I like it.
The roller coaster train has a wide angle camera, mm-hmm. so it's not like a moving camera or anything. And then a wide angle camera view gets then distorted into, so you can look around with 3D-off headset.
Oh, it's not rendered.
It's not rendered.
You're riding the camera.
Yes.
Wow.
I like that.
So it's not stereo.
I can't imagine it's stereo.
Yeah. That's cool though.
Yeah.
You know, that I would love to, like, to do some sort of a Legos type thing where you build something and then get to ride it rendered. That would be awesome.
What do you mean ride it rendered
though? Well, it would re-render whatever you construct in 3D based on what you just built in the real world.
How would it do that though?
You'd track the pieces?
You have to build it in an Amazon Go building.
100 cameras. Each Lego piece is identified with basically some type of tracking marker. Yeah. I think that'll do it for us this week. It is good to be back. Like I said before, the set looks great. Danica did a great job set designing and reorganizing, and a team here did a great job lighting everything. And it feels like the year is finally kicking off. So we're going to be back for more. We'll talk about what we've been testing next week, but do we have an outro this week?
Well, normally we do. Let's see here. I mean, I was expecting to talk about what we've been testing. I got some interesting things. Oh, so I can't wait to tell you next week.
We will talk about that next week. We're a little bit out of time.
Click the newest button, and we're going to scroll down. Here we go. This one is from Foggin. Maybe we've played it before.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
I want to do it with a pig now. Do it with a pig.
Tested.